Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Father Daniel, as always, great to see you.
Likewise, Chris. It's good to be seen.
Do you have a nice long homily planned for Palm Sunday to further lengthen that Mass?
Actually, I don't. I will be going on my annual retreat, so I will be in prayer for 8 days, all during Holy Week. I'm really looking forward
to it. Nice. Where are you going to be going on retreat?
I'm going up to our novitiate in Cheshire, Connecticut. So I'll spend it there, and I'm just really looking forward to it. The liturgies of Holy Week are so beautiful, and to be able to spend it in a climate of prayer, I'm really looking forward to it.
Great. Sounds awesome. Well, we're going to start this week in Ireland, where we've talked before about like what happened to Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
So a mutual friend of ours forwarded me a podcast done some time ago on First Things, which had an interesting perspective on why Ireland became so secular so quick.
Mm-hmm.
In this podcast, Father Peter Stravinskis from Philadelphia remembers a conversation he had with an Irish priest in 1983 when he was concelebrating a Mass there. The American priest remarked how lucky the Irish priest was with his sanctuary filled to the brim with churchgoers. The Irish priest responded and told him it was a mirage and it wouldn't last. This is in 1983.
83. Mm-hmm.
He said Ireland's Catholic culture was stronger socially than spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
His argument was that the church for a long time was the pillar of the social order. The church ran most schools, hospitals, and charities. People attended Mass because neighbors would notice if they didn't. And Catholic identity was tied to Irish nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
For decades in Ireland, Mass attendance was over 90%. But the Irish were told to, quote, pray, pay, and obey, and not really ask questions about their faith.
Mm-hmm.
This created a weak intellectual Catholic culture among many lay people, he says. The Irish priest was waiting for a reason to come along for the dam to break, and sure enough, the rapid arrival of modern consumer culture with the 1990s Celtic Tiger economy broke Ireland's long cultural isolation. Unlike France and Spain, which modernized gradually, Ireland's rapid and compressed modernization made traditional moral rules, especially around sexuality and authority, feel out of step with the broader Western world. When combined with the devastating reports in the early 2000s of the clergy sex abuse, their trust in the church as the moral authority collapsed quickly, he says, and this weakened the expectation. This is where he's getting to the point, the expectation to go to Mass. And once the social expectation dropped, Mass attendance dropped sharply, and now it's in low 30s or even 20s in most of Ireland, and only like 10% in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that theory?
It's a similar pattern to what we've seen in many other countries. Quebec, in our northern neighbor, had similar type of numbers in the past where of Mass attendance and everything, and it dropped off in the 50s. You look at Belgium. Belgium used to be send the most missionaries to different parts of the world. Now Belgium is a wasteland for the faith. And what we've seen throughout history is something that Alexis de Tocqueville pointed out, is that when the church becomes too allied with the powers that be in a political realm, it also will follow the fate of the politics. He warned of that in Democracy in America, in a book in 1830, and that pattern has been played out in several different times throughout history.
But what about this simple nuance of just the expectation to go to Mass?
Well, of course. I mean, one of the powerful elements of religion is that it helps shore up the social fabric of any culture that it's part of. And that can be for good, but when it becomes shallow and empty, an empty shell of itself, that's very problematic. I know a lot of priests from Ireland. We have a lot in the Archdiocese of Atlanta here who have priests who came over, they've incarnated here and contributed greatly to the evangelization of North Georgia. We also have, in my religious order, the Legionaries of Christ, we had a novitiate in Ireland starting in 1965, and several generations of wonderful Irish priests who were very dedicated men who really love the church and have done tremendous things for evangelization. But I've had conversations with many of these priests. These same elements have come out. There was somewhat of a shallow Catholicism in some parts. And sometimes there was an effort on the part of clergy, sort of clericalism, to not go in depth in the teaching of the whys behind
Really interests me. This theory on the expectation is, I don't know how many parishes you've been to, but at my own parish, we have the live streaming of the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can remember my parish is probably 50% larger than it was than when I joined it 30 years ago, right. almost 30 years ago. And the high Mass, the 10 o'clock Mass, we would consider, I guess, the high Mass was, you know, filled to the brim with people always standing down the side aisles. Mm. That's never the case unless it's a holiday, you know, a church holiday. And I have this, you know, nagging feeling that the live streaming that we do at our own church is one of the, you know, people feel like they can opt out, you know, even though it doesn't count for Mass and they may know that, they still feel like they're checking the box. And this expectation, I really worry that live streaming the Mass is going the wrong way.
Maybe, but at the same time, for certain people who are homebound, who can't get to Mass because of serious physical limitations or in the nursing home, I think it's a boon to have that availability for them. I think the problem lies in the catechesis once again, like helping people who do have the ability to go to Mass to realize it ain't the same.
Well, maybe if you're homebound, truly homebound, you know, can contact your pastor and get the secret password to get the live stream, you know, rather than just making it available to everyone.
Right.
I really don't like this excuse because I know several people who just watch it on TV now.
Yeah, but it's an opportunity to have a conversation with those people who say, hey, but what are you missing by not going? I mean, it's like the difference between going to a football game in a stadium and watching on TV. Sometimes you get better views on TV, but the whole sense, like the feel of being in the stadium and sharing with other people and the eruption of noise at certain moments that vibrates your whole body, there's a difference between going to the stadium or to the arena or watching it on TV. And I think in a shallow way, we can say that there's the same difference between watching a live stream and going to Mass, except that it's infinitely more important to go to Mass because we receive the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ when we receive the Eucharist.
And we also participate in the sacrifice of the Mass when we're actually there. I don't think we participate in the sacrifice when we're not there.
Well, you do vicariously. So I wouldn't go so far as to say that there's no value in,
live
streaming.
Right.
Right. But it's so much more that if anyone has the possibility to go to Mass, they should be going to Mass.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Father Dwight Longnecker in the Catholic Herald says just over 30 years ago, he was serving as a priest in the Church of England, and the debate over ordination of women to the priesthood was reaching its climax. He was the vicar of two rural parishes on the Isle of Wight, and the primary thrust of the argument for the ordination of women was that we have women doctors, women prime ministers, women in all top professions. Why not clergy?
Mm-hmm.
And that male-only priesthood was patriarchal and oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
When the vote went in favor of ordination of women, hundreds of clergy and thousands of lay people deserted, and many went to the Catholic Church, including Father Dwight Longnecker. So he argues that sentimentality won the day when they change the rules. So he argues that it still rules the day today and uses the example of the General Synod on February 14th, 2025, when then Bishop of London, Sarah Mullally, broke into tears after speaking about the institutional barriers and microaggressions that women in ministry still suffered.
Mm-hmm.
He points out that when someone cries, they immediately elicit sympathy, and the sympathy they garner can help them win their argument. We all know this.
Mm-hmm.
He says this is not restricted to women, as roughly 1 year later, a gay male Anglican priest gave a speech after the members of the Anglican ruling body rejected the blessing of same-sex marriages. The gay priest, in response, tearfully blamed the synod members for hurting him and other homosexual people. Gay marriage is not yet allowed in the Church of England, but Longnecker says it's only a matter of time.
Mm-hmm.
So he concludes, pointing out that when emotions are the only argument, then our emotions become good in our eyes. And once we have accepted that all our emotions are natural and good, we will accept the negative emotions of resentment, rage, lust for revenge, and also being not only justified, but good in themselves. I kind of liked how he summarizes this. What are your thoughts about that?
I think it's a great insight. There's a real tendency to have emotions trump reason. And let's face it, we have our emotions mixed up with our reason. We like to think we're really rational, but a lot of times we do make decisions based just on our emotion or an intuition. And I think that part of the intellectual heritage of Western thought is sorting out emotions and passions from reason and trying to get to a better and more reasoned way to approach reality. So it's really risky when you start to jettison rationality in favor of emotionalism, and which is often what's happening in politics, in these type of church decisions too. I had a really fascinating conversation last year with a high churchman in the Church of England. I was in London for a conference at the ARC conference, which was a really fascinating gathering. And there was a closing dinner, and I was sitting with at the table. There were 10 of us on the table. I think like 4 of them were from the Church of England. There was a Catholic bishop. There was a Catholic priest. There was a deacon, and from different parts of the world as well. So it was a very international scene. And right next to me was an archdeacon from the Diocese of Oxford, okay. In charge of all the properties. And in the Anglican Church, an archdeacon is kind of like an auxiliary bishop. And he had a lot of responsibility. And he was telling me about all the challenges going on in the Church of England and how they're getting down to about 1 or 2% of people go to Mass in the Church of England on a given weekend. He said, it's just like, it's empty churches. There's no future. There's nothing happening. There's doctrinal confusion. And then at one point he said to me, you know, and I've got my spiritual director is a Catholic priest. I said, really? Okay. Now I'm really curious. And so I asked him after we've been talking for about 45 minutes, I said, all right, I just have one question for you. Why aren't you Catholic?
Only a matter of time. It sounds like it's only a matter of time.
And he looked at me, and his answer actually kind of floored me. He said, well, my wife is an Anglican priest, and that's what's keeping me from becoming Catholic.
Wow. Well, you know that same Sarah Mulally that they used, that Longnecker uses in the example, you know that she this week was named the Archbishop of Canterbury. Mm. So now she is the formal head of the Anglican Church.
Yeah.
The other thing about this that makes me, that maybe I want to step back and think about just generally how Catholics versus Protestants approach worship of God is, I would generally say this has been my view, is that the Protestant services really kind of tap more into your emotion. And they're attractive
on the
because
church,
of that. You know,
yes,
I mean, like some of the ones that the kids go to that, you know, include bands and concerts. You know, it's like, I get how attractive this is because it really, you know, taps into something.
You feel good. You feel like you're being fed. Right. You feel like you're getting something out of it because it does tend, not all the churches, but many of them do appeal to the emotions. I was just listening yesterday to a history of Protestantism in the United States, and the whole Methodist movement was a method for eliciting the emotions. Mm. And these traveling itinerant preachers, they became experts at how to stir up the emotions of the people in revivals and in other moments through music. And then you get all these, you know, kind of weird derivations from that in different branches.
Well,
of
you get people complaining about sort of a stoic approach by the Catholic Church, but there's a beauty in the magisterium of the Catholic Church that doesn't rely on emotion. It's never swayed by emotion.
It goes much deeper than emotion, and it does evoke the emotions, but in line with reason and with faith and the higher values. And so, like, Catholic Church is not devoid of emotion. I mean, you think like the beauty of the music and the liturgy. Gregorian chant,
beauty of the cathedral,
the cathedrals, the artwork, the even like incense, which affects the senses and draws in the entire human person into worship of God. There are very beautiful and deep elements. And, you know, my sister-in-law, who converted from atheism and became Catholic, when I asked her, what was it that made you become Catholic? One of the two things that she noted was beauty. She just always found beauty in the Catholic Church that she couldn't find in the secular world.
And I think people who are not Catholic would be surprised to learn that so many Catholics will find some of the more emotional moments they spend within the Catholic realm is by themselves in adoration.
Oh, totally. I've had that conversation so many hundreds of times with different people, or in moments. For example, a few days ago we had this funeral for Father Michael Shannon, who was a good friend of mine, Legionnaire of Christ priest, who was auxiliary, the assistant associate pastor at St. Brendan the Navigator Parish. And you know, the funeral, you would think, oh gosh, a dark moment, very stoic, sober. It was beautiful. It was chock full of emotion. And I found myself tearing up. And I'm a pretty, you know, I try not to show my emotions too much.
You're an unemotional guy.
No, I'm not unemotional. I've got a lot of emotions. I hide them well. But I was tearing up because of the evocative nature of the liturgy itself that brings you through what, and I would posit in this way, an integration of the emotions into the worship of God and into rationality and faith and reason. So it's not Catholic Church is not opposed to emotions, but it's having them in their proper place.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. A bishop in San Diego from the Eastern Catholic Chaldean Rite was arrested in early March 2026. He's charged with misappropriating more than $270,000 of church funds tied to rental income from parish property. He's also alleged to have visited brothels in nearby Tijuana. Why do I bring this up?
Mm-hmm.
Not to pile on with all of the other media obsession with loudly proclaiming any instance of Catholic clergy error, but to point out how significant this arrest is and how rare it is. So there were two or three bishops that were prosecuted during the clergy sex scandal, but to my knowledge in doing research on this, there's never been a standing U.S. bishop facing prosecution for offenses involving church finances or anything else in the United States.
Mm.
So that's how rare it is.
Right.
So I don't want to ignore, I guess to bring it up, because I don't want to just ignore bad news about the Catholic Church, but I wanted to point out how rare it is. But also, maybe you could explain, too, what the Chaldean Rite is for those, because I had to look it up.
I was just going to ask you the same question. Come on, Chris. You put me on the spot here,
well,
but that's what we do, right?
It's from Iraq. I had to look it up.
Yeah, yeah. They're from Iraq.
The Iraqis and the Syriac Rite.
Yeah, so they're part of one of the, I think it's 24 different rites within the Catholic Church that are aligned with the Pope. They follow the authority of the Pope, but they have different liturgical and theological traditions that are legitimate within the orthodoxy of the church. A lot of Catholics, because we're all Latin rite for the most part here in the United States, and so we don't have a lot of experience of other rites within the Catholic Church that are legitimate, like the Chaldeans, the Maronite. I just preached a retreat recently at the St. Joseph's Parish here in Atlanta that's right off
Hammond.
Off Hammond Drive.
Yep.
You know, beautiful little church, and a lot of them are from Lebanon, and they have part of the liturgy in Aramaic and part in Arabic, parts in English, and they keep a lot of traditions of St. Charbel and beautiful things like that. They're fully within the communion of the Catholic Church, but they worship in a different way. And just as a side note, I think that's a really interesting way to overcome some of the liturgical battles that are going on about the traditional Latin Mass. Maybe considering that the possibility of a new rite within the Catholic Church that's fully in communion with the church. But setting aside that side note, coming back to the question of the Chaldean bishop, it opens up a question for me. I can't remember right now if Chaldean bishops I don't think bishops can get married within there. The priests, I think, can, but not bishops within the Chaldean church.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, I had to look it up, and you know, I'd heard the name before, but no idea what the the history was.
Yeah, it's a branch of Catholicism which has remained within Iraq, and now with the displacement of many Iraqis after the Operation Desert Storm, many Christians were forced out of the country because Saddam Hussein actually kept a detente between the Muslims and the Catholics and the Chaldeans in Iraq. And once Saddam Hussein was taken out of power, the Muslims really, they took complete control of the country, and the Catholics were forced out for the most part. So there's a big displacement around the globe. So there's a lot more Chaldean Catholics in different places around the world.
But only recently.
Yeah, only more recently. So in this case, coming back to your question.
Well, the main thing of the article was how rare this is for a standing bishop. You know, it's not always bad news. It's always gets projected as these clergy are always doing something wrong. Well, it's just really actually the opposite.
Often that's a great point.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
The German Bishops Conference, led by newly elected chairman Bishop Heiner Wilmer, plans to present a formal request to the Vatican seeking permission for qualified lay people to preach homilies during Mass.
The proposal, qualified lay people.
Right.
Okay.
I.e. not me.
I was just thinking, sorry, Chris, sorry to interrupt you, but my mind was just going with like, oh, all the complaints that priests hear about the long homilies, the boring homilies. I can just imagine when, unqualified lay people start preaching homilies.
Well, I'm already getting, I guess, part of your thoughts, but the proposal would allow theologically trained lay faithful commissioned by a bishop to preach on Sundays and feast days. And as you know, under canon law, the homily at Mass is reserved to priests and deacons.
That's right.
So, you know, what do you think about what Germany's doing amongst all the other things Germany's doing?
It's kind of silly because the option already exists there for qualified men to become deacons and then they can preach.
Yeah, good
point. So why not follow the path that's already laid out? It's kind of silly, if you ask me.
All right. Well, speaking of homilies separately, the Pope has cautioned, this is not just in Germany, he's cautioned priests against letting AI write their homilies.
Mm-hmm.
He said that preaching must come from a priest's own prayer, reflection, and experience of faith. One of his key points was a real homily is a sharing of faith, something AI cannot do. So I think he's worried about authenticity here. What do you think about his guidance?
I think it's a very valid point, but I would make a little bit of a distinction. I mean, it depends on how you're using AI, because I do use AI sometimes to generate ideas or put together a first draft. You can never leave it at that. I had a funny experience a few months ago. This is probably like 6 months ago now. I was back in my parents' parish. They live in north central Arkansas now. I didn't grow up there, but that's where they live. And I was, preaching the homilies at the weekend masses. And I was preaching different homilies. So I used AI to prepare one of the homilies for Saturday evening. And my mom came up to me afterwards and she said, "Did you use AI for that homily?" I said, "Mom, you know me too well. Yes, I did. I cheated." And she said, "Your homilies are so much better when you just, listen to the Holy Spirit."
Well, how did she sniff it out? What was it?
I don't know. Probably the fact that I was reading too much from the paper in front of me. And so the next morning, I totally just ripped up that homily and went just from my prayer.
Back to what you're doing when I ask you questions on Crossfire, which exactly. Is your gut response. No AI here.
Hopefully asking the Holy Spirit for guidance. Well, so the homily went way better. And my mom complimented me after and said, "That was so much better." So I think that's what the Holy Father's getting at. If we use a slavish use of AI for anything, for that matter, whether it's for court briefs, and we heard, recently in the news was in Georgia Supreme Court, there was an attorney who was arguing on behalf of the state, but put out a brief that had five citations of court cases that didn't exist. And the Supreme Justice had to remonstrate with this attorney, and she may get debarred. So it's improper use of AI, and you're not really using it well as a tool. You're letting it take over. And I think that's what the Holy Father's warning about. Not that we shouldn't use AI at all, but hey, preaching should come from our prayer. It should come from our experience of the faith. And I'm totally in agreement with the Pope on that.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
Do you know who Dennis Prager is?
I do indeed.
So for those that don't, he's the conservative radio talk show host known for his advocacy of Judeo-Christian values. And he had a catastrophic fall in his home in November of 2024, which left him paralyzed from the shoulders down.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know this either until I saw the story. He had written a book back in 1998 called Happiness is a Serious Problem. And he has a piece in the Wall Street Journal noting that everything he wrote was put to the test when he was paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
His 1998 book stressed two things. First, happiness isn't to be awaited, but must be pursued. Second, expectations are a major impediment to happiness. They undermine the greatest source of happiness, which is gratitude. So he went from a high-flying media life to one of being bedridden, yet he maintains that his low expectations are why he continues to be happy to be alive. How do you like his advice and that the keys of to happiness are low expectations and gratitude?
I would agree with the gratitude piece. The low expectations, I think we'd have to put a little bit more parameters around it. And also the first point he mentioned, can you go back what you said? What was the first thing that he mentioned?
He says that happiness isn't to be awaited, but must be pursued.
Yeah, I would take a little bit of a different approach there as well. Happiness is kind of a byproduct. When you're pursuing happiness, it tends to elude you. And instead, when you are pursuing the things that lead to a fulfilled life and ordered life with God, it comes as a byproduct.
Yeah, I think I agree with what you just said. I think that that's great advice because, yeah, pursuing happiness as its own goal really is going to result in...
result in selfishness. I mean, I was talking with a guy this morning and we were talking about, like, he'd, you know, just come back from a ski trip, you know, spring break, and went someplace with his family and, you know, had lots of fun. But then we were comparing that to the experience of going on a mission trip to serve other people. And we both have had the experience, like, there's so much more joy and happiness when you go somewhere, not for yourself, but to do something good for others. You feel like you just feel so much more fulfilled.
Yeah, I guess to finish what I was going to say was that I think when you're pursuing happiness as the goal, it's just going to result in you requiring the next thing. You're going to realize that didn't do it. You're going to have to do the next thing. So I like this idea that it's a symptom of a fulfillment that you get otherwise.
Yes. And it's not just any old fulfillment, because I can't just arbitrarily choose, like, okay, I'm going to be fulfilled because I have a hobby of, I don't know, raising cats. Okay. Now I'm a cat person and I am going to raise cats and cats are going to be the fulfillment of my life. Well, I'm sorry, but cats are never going to fulfill your life because we were made for more than that. And so it's not about just simply arbitrarily setting a goal or something that I'm going to find purpose in arbitrarily. They have to be things that objectively in God's order do lead to fulfillment. And that's where relationships, serving others, loving others, being in presence of God, those are things that fulfill the human heart at the deepest level.
Well, and cats are never going to make you happy. Cats were made to annoy you. As soon as they go out, they want to come back in.
Well, I would not disagree with you, but some people out there might love cats, and I think cats like go really well with certain personalities, but not mine.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crosswires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens. On AM 1160, The Quest.